Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to this Zone File Access Advisory Group conference call. I hope that everyone has received a copy of the agenda, and Rod and Vladimir, Dave Piscitello, Mark McFadden, and I met a little bit earlier in the week to talk about the agenda. And what I will do is first take roll call and then maybe talk about one or two administrative items, and then I'm going to turn the meeting over to Rod Rasmussen for today. So starting with roll call, Mikey O'Connor?
I'm here.
Great. Thanks, Mikey. John Levine? What about Nacho Amadoz? Adam Palmer? David Maher? Vladimir, I know, is on the line. Brian Cute. Tom Barrett, I know, is on the line.
Yep.
Paul Stahura. Rick Wilhelm, I know, is on the line.
Yep.
James Blado, I know, will not be with us today. Tatiana.
Okay.
Great. Rod Rasmussen, we know, is on the line. Rod Dixon. What about Joe St. Sauve?
I'm here.
Hi, Joe. Wang Wei? John Christoph? Jonathan Frakes? Teresa Lopes? Asif Kabani? What about Barry Cobb?
Present.
Hi, Barry. What about Susan Prosser?
I'm present.
Hi, Susan. John McCormick?
I'm here.
Hi, John. And what about Ken Stubbs? Okay, we have a thinner than normal group today, but we'll obviously press forward anyway. In terms of the administrative items on the agenda, you can see item 1.2 is shifting the meeting, or discussion about shifting the meeting from 60 to 90 minutes. Someone had raised it on the list, and I know a few folks have chimed in or at least contacted me directly saying that they think that it makes sense given the work that we need to do and the time that we have to do it. So I'd like to either open the floor to one of the two chairs to speak on this or to the floor itself.
This is Rod. I, given that we went over by 10 or 15 minutes last time, I think it's just prudent to plan for, or at least allow for the extra time to be able to discuss things.
There's a lot of static coming from someone's line right now.
Yeah, I'm hearing it too. Well, let's see if it's... Nope.
let me just mention this to the operator real fast. That went away.
Yep. Okay.
Are there other folks on the phone who have an opinion?
This is Rick Wilhelm. It's probably a good idea to. We've been tight every time, so it's probably a good idea to allocate 90, even if we don't burn it all.
Yeah, this is Mikey. I'm fine with 90.
Okay,
this is Vladimir, and I would like to add that we can go back to 60 if we feel that we have too much time.
Well, it sounds like we ought to plan for 90, but then if we finish up early, we finish up early.
Yep.
Moving to a review of the open action items, I'll quickly go through these. We have the articulation of a CUS problem statement, which we discussed at a great length on last week's call and also circulated to the group. Item number two is the comments and analysis for version 3 of the applicant guidebook, and I sent those comments. There are very few about zone file access. I sent those around to the group yesterday, and if anyone has comments or feedback on that, I suggest that we handle that through the list.
One problem statement, is that the version out of somewhere? Because I was through the archive.
I'm sorry, say it again.
The version of the problem statement that's current. So I don't know if I saw a revision or where we ended up after the discussion last week. I don't know if I saw that on email.
Okay, we'll make sure that we send it back around on after today's call.
Yeah, so I had the original one, and then we had good dialogue on what the puts and takes were, but I don't think we kind of had, here's the one that we're talking about.
Craig, this is Vladimir. Maybe it would be a good idea to publish the problem statement as soon as it's agreed on the website. Because I actually have the same problem. We had one initial version with lots of addition, and I'm not 100% sure which was the latest one.
Okay. Well, I know that Mark took notes based upon last week's call, and we'll get that circulated after today's call. Have whatever kind of final discussion we need to have on the list, and then publish it for next week. Is everybody okay with that? Great. Item number three, open agenda items or open action items. The MP3 of the initial meeting is published on the website, so we don't need to list that any longer. The Craig write up notes of call with VeriSign, and I have done that, and I'll speak to that when we get to agenda item number two on today's call. Check with affiliates to see if Zone File Access consumer information can be shared. I have reached out to Brian. He said that he would respond. I haven't gotten anything yet. I've also reached out to Eric Brown at Newstar, and I'm awaiting some input from them as well. So as soon as I have it, I will share it. Item number six, schedule a call for the next agenda, which is done. Send the registry constituency comments to the Zone File Access list, and that is completed. And request to consumers of Zone File information share experiences. And that's a lot of the dialogue that happened on the list after last week's call, I think from Susan and from John and from a few other folks. So those are all the what were listed as the open action items. In terms of the statements of interest in closing the group membership, I think we all agreed that after this week's call, the group would be closed to new folks. We are missing two statements of interest from people that have not been on any of the calls. So I will follow up with them today to let them know that the group is moving forward and participation is now closed off. So those are all the administrative tasks. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Rod and Vladimir with item number two.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, everybody, for coming on today and sticking with the agenda here. And I think we had really good dialogue, especially the first couple of days after the meeting last week. It's a lot of interesting ideas, good feedback on several different topics on the list. I think we made some good progress in getting more information in front of everybody. I hope everybody's had a chance to kind of digest the paper, at least the main parts of that, and take a look at some of the comments that were put in on both on our call last week and on the list as far as some of the concerns that have been raised. I think some really good issues have been raised as far as what we're up to and what the objectives are. I think that there's been a couple of different ideas and some tangents and et cetera that have been submitted that were not really part of the original part of the program that we'll probably want to address, but I think if we concentrate on fairly narrowly getting forward here on examining the issues and coming up with some different alternatives, pros and cons around those, that we can put together something pretty solid pretty quickly. I think that the amount of information, if we look at the main problems that we're trying to solve here, which is, you know, scaling access for large numbers of registries in the future here, then we can deliver something pretty tight. I wanted to get any, I know we have several different kinds of, several different topics here. An item two, talking about the community concerns, I wanted to make sure that there were, if there were anything else out there that hadn't been brought up or addressed yet, that people had a chance to bring those concerns up. So are there any other concerns or issues that people have thought of that haven't really been discussed yet or put on the list, or put that were put on the list that people feel weren't really talked about yet? Throw that out to the floor. Okay. Taking silence as there weren't anything, at least anything major out there. I think we've got then some, hopefully, a full embodiment of the various issues that have been discussed here in the calls and in the mailing list as well. And we have, in light of the lack of concerns that were added, do we want to move on to empirical data? And I know that we've gotten some brought in back. Craig, did you want to talk to those highlights?
I'm actually not sure, Rod, what you're referring to on that item.
Well, I was looking at 2.2. I don't. Maybe I'm thinking of 2.3 with the VeriSign.
Yeah, sure. I could certainly speak to 2.3.
Yeah. What remind me again what we're thinking about with 2.2 then, separate from the VeriSign info.
Mark, can you chime in on that item, Mark McFadden?
Yeah, give me just a second here. Can we come back to that? And I will. Let's loop back around and after.
Sure.
Had a chance to talk about the VeriSign one.
Yeah,
sure.
I think if I remember right, it was just basically the amount of number of users using the system and number of credentials that have been revoked over time across all registries. But maybe it was just the VeriSign had the revocation numbers.
Sure. I'll speak to item 2.3. And again, obviously, this is Craig Schwartz. So I did have a discussion last week with Joe Waldron, who's the director of product development at VeriSign, on VeriSign's experience with the Zone File Access Agreements. And I think Joe has been with VeriSign 9 or 10 years, or if it's not 9 or 10, it's a very long period of time. And so Joe is intimately involved with all of what goes on in VeriSign's naming services division. With respect to the question about the number of problems and terminations that they've had over the years, his comment was that they've actually had very few terminations of Zone File Access Agreements, primarily because it's very difficult to determine, you know, where to connect a complaint or bad behavior to a particular user. He said the cost of trying to do this versus the benefit that they would get from spending the time and energy on it, he said it hasn't paid, and they haven't spent time on this. To the discussion about collecting additional data from registries on their experiences, he said he just doesn't see that there's much value in it. He says it's almost impossible to trace the behaviors or complaints to a specific user. And then I developed a list of general comments that he made, and I'll go through some of those. He said that investigations are very difficult and expensive. He said enforcement is very difficult. He said the system could be improved if users were validated, but what's the cost benefit of developing such a system when there's so few instances of problematic users, and the real harm of malicious use of zone file data is truly questionable. He said users can sign up one day under one access name and then do it again under another access name. So he kind of likened it to the whack-a-mole game that, you know, if a bad actor goes away, they just show up under a different type of username and access code. So, again, a lot of time and energy tracking down very few problems. Joe's comment, and this was something that was discussed on the call last week, is that zone file data itself cannot be used for malicious behavior, although he acknowledges that it is the key to other activities, and I think that we've talked about that a great deal. He did raise the comment of why not allow the market to create the service if there's really a need, and I think we've heard maybe someone else make that same statement. And he did raise the notion of the aggregator, that the aggregator is going to have a cost, and question who's going to pay. You know, the aggregator is going to need, you know, engineers and legal staff and infrastructure, enforcement, et cetera. And again, I think this was brought up on the call by someone else. So the cost element is certainly something to be, you know, aware of. VeriSign said that they'd be happy to respond to an additional data collection questionnaire if we had one, but again, he doesn't see much value. They've had very few problems over the last 9 or 10 years, and it doesn't sound like they spend a lot of time and energy tracking this particular issue.
Correct. This is Vladimir. Did VeriSign say anything specific about the cases when the zone file access agreement was indeed terminated?
The one example that was presented to me was when they had a user who was trying to download zone file data sometimes in excess of 25 times a day. And, I mean, zone file data is only updated a couple of times a day, so to ping it 25 times a day doesn't seem to make sense. So that's one of the cases where they actually followed up with the user and terminated the agreement and or had the user modify their behavior. But I spoke to two different people at VeriSign, and terminating access agreements just is not something that happens.
This is Joe. Can I get in the queue?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, the evidence that we're hearing from VeriSign at least sort of makes me wonder whether or not we're sort of solving a problem that may be intentionally a little too hard right now. If we don't need to worry about access control, the whole thing kind of becomes a whole lot easier. I think we know how to distribute data in pre-scalable ways. Access control isn't part of the problem.
Well, and that's just VeriSign's experience. All of the GTLD registries do have the same zone file access agreement, and that's what they, you know, the questions that are in that agreement, which is Appendix 3 to the registry agreements, are the questions they ask. I know VeriSign in particular, they also do ask what the data will be used for, but I can't imagine that anyone would ever say anything that would cause VeriSign to deny it just based upon on use.
Right, so I guess my point is that they're not really saying no to people when they apply, and if they're not saying get off to people who've gotten access but then abused it, I mean, it seems like, you know, we have some hurdles that may not need to be there.
Yeah, that's a valid point. It'll be interesting to see what Neustar and Afilias come back with, since between the three of those registries, they are the back end or the registry operator for the vast majority of the 17, you know, current GTLD registries.
Another question, Craig, Vladimir. Do we have, maybe it's not you, but someone else from ICANN could tell when was this current system of zone file access designed, and what was the rationale for creating the system in the shape that now exists? I mean, were there any discussions about publicizing the zone file? Were there any discussions about restricting access? About the how was the agreement formed? I assume it was quite a few years ago. So maybe there are some additional materials on the ICANN website that members of the group would be useful to read.
Yeah, Vladimir, I pulled up a quick registry agreement from 2000. I pulled up NewSTARS, and I could see that they have a zone file access agreement. So it looks like we've been doing it at least since ICANN started administering TLD agreements. I don't know if anyone on the line has a historical perspective on the rationale for zone file access, but I could certainly do some digging internally to find out where that came from and why.
This is John Levine. Can I get in the queue?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Hi. Zone files have always been available. I mean, back when the Internet was new, there was an FTP server and you could download stuff, you know, and that regime is still around for .ARPA and the root.
Okay.
So I think you can go back and look, but I think the answer you'll get is well, we, you know, it was always there, and there was no interest in getting rid of it. Also, getting back to Joe's thing, I think it would also be interesting to keep in mind the relative number of people looking at the different zones. VeriSign has about 900. I just got a password for .tel this morning. I just need to be number 45. So the number of people interested in zones other than the big one seems to be very small.
Yeah, I actually, if you give me a second, I can pull up. I have an account from some from the registry reports that are posted online.
Yeah, I've looked at some of them too. I think very few of them have even as many as 100 passwords.
Yeah, I can't put my fingers on it real quickly, but I know .org, .biz, .info, CommonNet all have on the order of 500 to 1,000 passwords that have been issued for those TLDs, and then
right.
every other one is 100 or less.
Yeah, that matches what I remember.
And if the group's interested in seeing the specific numbers from the most recently available reports, I'm happy to circulate that around to the group.
Yes, please.
Okay.
This is Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mark. This is exactly what I was talking about in 2.2, is the sort of empirical data that's available from the monthly reports. And as far as I can tell, the most recent of the monthly reports that's available is September. And if we want to just grab some statistical information there, I'm happy to put the cycles together to do that.
Okay. Well, Mark or I will take care of that, and we'll circulate it to the group.
And this is Rod. I think that one of the things you'll see, too, is a correlation between, at least in the smaller ones, between whether or not the zone is somewhat restrictive in there and how you can obtain a domain in it. Versus interest in examining those zone files. I know from an e-crime perspective, if it's a very high bar to get into a zone, we're not going to spend a lot of time looking for bad guys in there. And I'm sure that trademark protection and other potential uses aren't going to be spending a lot of time trying to set up things where there's not very, very unlikely that they're going to find anything they're looking for. That being said, there's, you know, with the new GTLDs coming along, who knows what all models we're going to have. So, yeah, I don't know, we may have some big ones and small ones, but it may not correspond necessarily to the size of the zones themselves as far as consumer interest.
It sounds to me like we've probably exhausted item number two.
Yeah.
And maybe and move on to review of consumer experiences in the current Zone File Access environment.
I think we had some great input on the list on that. And it actually was kind of interesting seeing that different people had different problems with different parts of the process but thought the other parts of the process were pretty easy. And I think I didn't put my own experience in there, but I think it kind of was a meld of the two. It was, you know, a little bit difficult to find some agreements. You know, setting things up for a couple of them was pretty easy. For a couple of them, it took a lot of, you know, emails and phone calls and beating on, you know, registries to get them to get something set up. Zone files mysteriously not being published or updated for days at a time without any explanation. But in general, once you've got it set up, it just kind of works. I think, I don't know if that's fairly typical, but my own personal experience kind of crosses some of the other experiences that were listed on the list. Anybody else have their own experiences that they wanted to kind of throw into the bin here too? Okay. Was there any feedback on what was put on the list, and you know, looking towards 3.3, how, you know, what are people's thoughts about how the experiences, you know, in the past should guide where we're going to move in the potential future models? Go on, speak up at once.
This is Mikey. I'll help you out, Rod. This last little bit of conversation, triggered partly by what Joe said, sort of has me wondering whether we want to step back from this and see if we're solving a problem that we don't really need to solve just yet. And that maybe what we want to do is have a plan in place if things go badly. But if folks don't really run into a scaling problem, maybe we're ahead of the game. I don't know. That's just a thought that's popped in my head on this latest.
I think we're intentionally ahead of the game in that we don't have new TLDs. We don't know how many they're going to be.
Yeah.
But that we want to have something in place so that, especially I think for planning for the new registries, in discussions with several people who are going to be running new registries potentially, if they're approved, this is part of what they don't want to have to deal with as far as standing up a new registry, and be very happy to be able to say, hey, I can handle if there's this central way of distributing zone files, and I'll just push it into that, and I don't have to worry about all this other stuff that I have to get established.
Well, the interesting question on my mind is sort of what the costs are and who bears them. In fact, we're working on something that has 500 customers or less. It seems like at some point we might want to run a few numbers and see where those costs fall out and for whom.
This is Vladimir Mitch. I mean,
go ahead, I'll drop off.
So, in my opinion, there is some, let's say, threshold below which, if the problem is not enough serious, then maybe, probably, a good idea would be to rely on market forces to fill the gap and create the service that is required by the market. If we go above some threshold, then maybe it's more reasonable to impose some new system on the registries, right? So what we need to determine here is whether what that system would be, if we need one, what that would be, what are the costs, and these costs should be justified by the level of seriousness of the problem.
This is Joe. Can I jump back in?
Yeah, go ahead.
So just to be clear, what I was saying is that there's no evidence that people are actually sort of policing the zone file uses, and there's no evidence that people basically are effectively using the authentication controls and the access controls. Maybe what we really ought to do is recommend a model that scales very well, something like having essentially open access. It could be via the existing FTP servers without a username and password pair. It could be via web pages. It doesn't really matter the underlying technology in that regard. If you remove the access control authentication chunk of this, it really becomes a far simpler problem. And we know how to serve documents to the Internet, and we have many technologies for doing that, like the web.
I think that's an excellent point here, is that if the current registry system or registry operators are not doing anything to control access or the like, you know, a lot of these issues just disappear. You may as well just publish things, or for that matter, allow AXFR transfers out of your DNS servers. And kind of ugly, but I mean, it's the way that you can get some zones today. So there's a multitude of ways to get zones to people who are consumers of the data, if there's no actual concern about who's getting the information. I think getting some input from the registries on that question, you may get a quite different response than we've gotten so far. If you start saying, well, gee, if you're not going to patrol it, why don't we just open it up to everybody? I think there's a political element there that may rear its head pretty quickly.
This is Rick Wilhelm. Can I jump in queue?
Yep.
I don't think that it's fair to say that they don't patrol it, right? It's more that it's the notion of accountability, that the fact that there is someone signing up and there is someone that they have problems, in other words, the presence of a lock is enough of a deterrent to keep the really, any really unsavory folks from being ongoingly aggressive about it. While it's true that they're not needing to, but the fact that they have this ability to shut people off is actually one of the things that helps keep it from being a cesspool. It's sort of an opinion.
But I share that opinion too. I think that's the reality of it. It's just kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, so I wouldn't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater and just say, well, because X, Y, Z, then we shouldn't authenticate at all.
Hey, Vladimir, can I jump in?
Yep.
I completely agree with Rick, and I think that the fact that there were just a few terminations of the agreement is not something we should base ourselves on. Because opening the zone file to the public creates a completely different set of problems, which I'm not sure we would really be interested to consider here. And I really doubt that a suggestion of that kind would be supported by the registries.
Agreed.
That same feeling.
This is Barry. May I get in the queue, please?
Yep.
Go ahead, Barry.
I'm just curious, it's really a hypothetical question. So let's say we did centralize zone file access and we locked it down and we can vet the end users and to what access they get to which zone files, et cetera. So let's say we implement that. And also understanding today that there is some malicious use of the zone files out there in terms of either garnering email addresses for phishing or spamming and different kinds of cases. So if we could hypothetically implement our centralized zone file access and control who has access and lock out all the bad guys that we think may be using it today, would we see a significant difference in malicious use out there? And if I think that if there's any kind of indication that there is a, would be a significant difference, then we're on the right path. If there's not that much of a significant difference, then again, maybe we're back to trying to solve a problem for which, or come up with a solution for which there really isn't a problem.
I don't know how to answer the question. Are we going to see a significant change in malicious use? And my personal opinion is you're probably not. But that was the original intent of this. At least my thought of the original intent of this is to make sure that you weren't making it so onerous to be able to get the zone files if you wanted them from hundreds of different registries that you wouldn't be able to do so. That it really comes to a scaling, resource and cost issue on the consumer side was the main driver rather than.
All right, and I would agree with that. But isn't the very reason that both of these advisory groups were started was to minimize the malicious abuse out there in reference to the high security PLD and in reference to zone file access? Isn't that the key for why these groups got started?
Yeah, that's the framework it's under. My thinking on that is that people are using zone file access. So many consumers of the data are using that data to find malicious use out there. And what you're doing is making it more difficult for them to be able to find that malicious use by having a massive amount of work they have to do in order to get the zones.
Right. If you look at the IP community are big consumers of zone file data in the kind of anti cyber squatting and trademark infringement efforts that they take on behalf of their clients. So they are big consumers of the data. So when we use the term malicious malicious conduct or malicious activities fairly loosely. And Rod is right that centralized zone file access is one of the concepts under the mitigating malicious activity overarching issue. And if you look at it from the perspective of consumers of zone file data, such as IP trademark folks, the fact that they can get data for more TLDs more easily, it helps them. I think it would help them do their job more effectively. So if you throw cyber squatting or trademark-related issues into the category of malicious activities, it seems like there is a direct correlation.
And it's not just trademarks. I mean, law enforcement / security.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I was just citing one example.
Yeah. Want to make sure we get everybody's concerns in there because sometimes that leads to interesting results. I think that was a driver on this. And then there's certainly a secondary concern of, what can bad guys do with this information? And if you've got a hodgepodge system, are there holes in it? I don't know how much that second concern actually is and how much it's being abused today. We've only got a few examples of people being terminated, but it's so hard to find the bad guys and the abusers of the system that it's not worth it for the registries to pursue it, was at least the one feedback. I postulate that perhaps if you do have a more active shepherd of the data, so to speak, in a unified model, that organization would be more, probably a little more diligent about going after abusers, and may be able to weed out a few that the individual registries haven't been able to up to this date.
Can I jump in one more time, Mr. Joe?
Yep.
So I think the other thing that you have to keep in mind, though, is that there's effectively an infinite pool of people who can sign up to receive the zone file. So as a result, you have basically the ability for someone to sign up, get it once, abuse it, be terminated, and then the process can iterate effectively infinitely. So unless you go ahead and somehow limit that pool of qualified applicants, I think you're always going to go ahead and have potential for abuse effectively and unlimited.
Right. I guess the question with that, and that's a good point, I guess the question for that is, well, is the current model more or less susceptible to that kind of gaming the system? I think it's probably a little bit more susceptible if you can go from registry to registry. Kind of like the bad guys today, if somebody, a registrar or registry, is getting a lot of abuse, they'll clamp down on that, whatever that avenue is, and they'll just move on to another one.
And, of course, once they have one copy of the files, they can go ahead and replicate them effectively infinitely, just the way they do for things like, copywritten media and movies and songs and so forth.
And if you have a zone file once, it doesn't change that much over time, and it does, but not a ton.
This is Mikey again. I'd like to get in the queue.
Yeah, Mikey.
So I think what we are talking about here is sort of the pain for change problem. And I think that what we've got is a pretty good description of where we want to get, and that what we might want to do is beef up the why we want to get there part. And we also might want to beef up the costs and benefits part. Because it will be a lot easier for people to understand why to do this if we have a better case built. So the topics that we've just talked about, I think, are all good ones to go into that case. One of the things we might want to do is sort of expand the cost and benefits portion of the case as well. I don't want to leave people the impression that I'm against this. I think it's probably a pretty good idea, but I don't know that we've documented the reasons very well yet.
Yeah, that actually means that we probably need to transition to the next topic, but I think that allows us to do that, because if we're talking costs, you have different models that you can utilize, and we're kind of getting to that anyways. I think that there's certainly several reasons outlined in the current version of the paper, but we don't have a lot of input, at least on as to what it currently costs to run the current model. Craig, is that something we might be able to get some of the registries to comment on, as how much they're spending as far as resources and time and et cetera under their current systems?
We could certainly ask.
Yeah, we could obviously put together kind of a WAG as to what that is. And I know that there's a couple of the smaller registries out there that have made some comments about that they would like to be able to offload the cost-less responsibilities. And Nacho in particular had mentioned something about that. So maybe we could get a couple of the smaller ones to pipe up about what their experience has been, and I think they could speak directly to this issue of why they might want to reduce those costs or what have you, and responsibilities for that matter.
Yeah, I'll follow up with VeriSign affiliates and Neustar on the that item.
This is Mike. Can I just jump in real quick?
Yep.
Craig, when you ask them how much money they spend on bandwidth, because it seems to me that the biggest cost of this for the registries has got to be the bandwidth of delivering those giant, especially for VeriSign, the bandwidth required to deliver that giant .com zone file 900 times a day, times umpty ump gig, whatever it is. It's got to be a boatload of money for bandwidth. But maybe bandwidth has gotten so cheap that it doesn't matter.
What's their bandwidth for just providing access to the com servers? And at the end of the day, it might just be free.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe it's just lost in the rounding form.
Right.
Also, they're rate limited. I mean, like, I'm trying to get the common net files now, and it says my password is bad, so I presume their server's overloaded.
This happens all the time. This happens
all the time.
Yeah.
Pretty true.
Vladimir, can I jump in the queue?
Yes.
Can I go ahead?
Sure.
Similarly, I would like to have some more detailed feedback from the consumer side.
Do we have any indication of the scope of the problem from the consumer side? By that I mean, how many zone file consumers exist out there that do need access to multiple zone files, and who are likely to need access to the zone files for new TLDs? And similarly, I would like to get some information on what their costs are for administering the access and actually, this is, I think, the main concern, so that the problem lies in the excessive costs for administering multiple connections. So, in that regard, maybe it's again a question to ICANN. Do we have any mechanisms in place to get some more public comment on it?
It's a good question, Vladimir. I know that we've got a few folks that join the group as, you know, specifically as consumers of data. Yeah, I don't know. I think we need to have another conversation about putting out some kind of broad announcement requesting information from consumers. I think we need to take that discussion. I think we need to table that one for a moment and maybe take that one offline.
Yeah, and I think we do have several consumers on this group. I know I can pretty easily put together a costing of what we're spending to get the zones we get and what it would cost, you know, to stand up another one. We, you know, do that fairly often. And, you know, I shouldn't say fairly often. There's not that many zones, but we've done it more than once, that's for sure. And, you know, I'm more than willing to put some numbers to that as to how much it costs to set it up and in some regard maintain it. I think there's one of the consumers on the list that could probably speak to that as well, since they're doing this as part of their normal course of business. I think it's pretty straightforward to estimate those.
This is Susan. I can speak to that as well off list.
This is Mikey. I think that what would be really useful is on both the provider and the consumer side, if we could develop a cost model that then we could start throwing some assumptions at to see if the costs don't. You know, if in fact we've got a scaling problem and the costs explode, then that really helps make the case for another solution. And it also gives us a sense of the sort of size of budget we might be able to throw at that solution. And I think all of those would be really helpful. And I tend to agree with Craig that I'm not sure we need to go out to the general public for comment on that. I think it might be good to draw on the experts that we've got in the group already to at least build that model. And then once we've thrown some assumptions at it, maybe take that study out for public comment so that people could say, no, wait a minute, those assumptions are really wrong, or you missed a piece of the model. But I don't think an open-ended public comment request right now would produce much except sort of anecdotal result, and I'm not sure that's really what we're after.
Could we poll the registrants who currently have access?
That would presumably have to be done through the registries.
The problem is we certainly do have contact information for all the parties that signed the zone file access agreement. The problem is we have no idea which ones of these are actually professional consumers. So, for example, you said that Telnik has 45 zone file agreements in place. That may be true. I don't remember the exact number. So it may be the case then that out of these 45 people, 40 do need access to all the other zone files. And then, or it may be the case that just five of them do need access to other zone files. And this makes problem really different.
This is Mikey again. I think Joe raises a good point, though. It would be very useful to at least speculate on the proportion of sort of professional zone file consumers who pull data from multiple nodes versus folks like me. I'm in the .com list. I got it. I pulled the file down a couple of times and never did again. Again, to understand the demographics of the consumer community, I think, would be another really helpful and a minimum assumption to throw at it, but to be able to confirm that somehow.
All right. I think we're coming up on 8:30 here. We have a couple other topics we want to get to. So.
Rod, can I throw one more cost question at this before we leave this topic? What we've been talking about is sort of out-of-pocket costs, tangible costs that presumably flow through somebody's income.
Right.
Payment. But I think there's also the cost that you sort of alluded to in your comments. And I have no idea how to approach this topic, so I'll just throw it out there and let it steam on the table. And that is, what's the cost of not being able to acquire data that is needed in order to combat malicious use? It's almost an opportunity cost. But I think that without some acknowledgement of that, we miss a pretty big piece of the conversation.
Yeah. I think our cost talk here has actually gotten, it's a really a topic. So it kind of crosses between item 3 and 4 anyways. Were there any comments on the actual models that we've discussed so far on the list? We had the two that were in the paper, and I had kind of a third one that was proposed and kind of kicked around a bit, where we had a standardization of how access is acquired, but the actual registries and just have run basically the same system for each registry, so that it makes it, from a consumer perspective, all they have to do is use the same system and just access different points for it. So it's a little bit different model, but making things streamlined, I think, was the goal there, simplifying things. Were there any? I'm going to skip to kind of combine 4.1 and 4.3. Was there any more discussion on that, and any other thoughts on other models that we might want to do? Then we'll come back to the spamming issue. So that's the floor.
This is Vladimir. I can only say that my intention is to discuss this issue of pros and cons of the models under discussion with my fellow registries. So I hope within a week or two I'm going to have some more results on it.
And obviously getting some feedback on the ideas that are on the table from the people who have having to deal with that would be awesome to have that. And it might spur some other ideas as to alternatives or amendments to those models that would work well for everybody.
This is Mikey. Just to bang on the cost drum a little bit, I think it would be nice to sort of understand the cost implications of the various models as well. Again, that's where a costing model would be useful. If it turns out that bandwidth isn't really the issue, and one model is really designed to minimize bandwidth, then we're sort of barking up the wrong tree. That's why I'm so keen on this costing modeling. And Rod, if you and I wanted to hop offline and do something back and forth with an Excel spreadsheet, I'd be happy to help with that.
One other factor to consider when it comes to cost, too, especially if it's bandwidth costs, is that centralization may allow for economies of scale that you won't get if there are many small bandwidth purchases involved. So, for example, if you're buying in bulk, $5 a megabit per second per month is not an unreasonable number to expect to see.
Exactly. This is Rick Wilhelm, but at the same time, as somebody said, these registry operators running their DNS clouds really chew up a lot of bandwidth on DNS queries.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'd totally forgotten about the fact that those folks are probably buying the cheapest bandwidth there is. And so then the question is whether on the consumer side there is a bandwidth savings to be found. And I think that is where Joe's point is probably going to be more likely to bear.
This is John McCormick. Can I chime in here?
Yep.
The main problem for consumers is computation cost rather than bandwidth. Also on backup, as in backing up the zone file to a DVD every day or whatever, and hard drive space. Bandwidth is almost too cheap to meter now.
Yeah, I would say that it's computational, and it's also coordination. And you don't get to get away from that, really, when you start adding hundreds of registries. You just have to deal with it. But, you know, you've got a far more complex set of data that you're trying to merge together. And depending on how you're trying to do it, it can be interesting. I think on the producer side, so to speak, the costs are really going to be centered around having to make a service available of any sort. Right? You know, you're basically required to provide this service. And it doesn't matter whether it's a 1 or 10,000 users, at least at the scale they're doing zone files. I mean, doing just their DNS resolutions. That's, you know, it's far smaller than that anyways. But, you know, I have to stand up servers. I have to make sure they're running. You know, all those kinds of just issues that go on. And then you have to deal with, you know, sign-ups and all that. You know, you've got legal overhead and things like that to review it. You know, in theory, security/abuse monitoring. So I think those are the drivers on the producer side for the most part. And the bandwidth and actual, you know, the kind of thing that's the everyday expense thing is actually fairly small just in comparison to just running it in the first place. So, thought there.
Yeah, see, I think if we drove all that into a little cost model, Rod, and then took the three proposed models that we're talking about in this section of the agenda and banged them up against that cost model, we might learn some stuff that would be useful.
Yeah, I think it would help make a case one way or the other, especially when you blow that up into, you know, you've got today's world and you've got, you know, say 100 registries and you could do 1,000 registries and, you know, you can see where that takes you.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's some real value in doing that.
I want to contribute.
Anybody else want to help out with that project? Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say, I certainly agree, and if you need help with that, let me know.
Yeah, and Rod, I'm in on that one, too.
Okay, so Mikey, Joe, myself, anybody else want to be on that little sub-working group?
I'm happy to help also, Joe. I mean, Rod, this is Susan.
Okay, great.
And, okay, Rod, this is Rick Wilhelm. I can chime in from time to time also.
Okay. Cool. I'll send out an email to the four of you now. I guess I'll CC myself. And then we'll start putting together a spreadsheet and get a model together that we can play with.
Craig, could you turn around the MP3 on this call fairly quick? Because a lot of the line items in this model we've sort of talked off in the call. It'd be helpful to get that again.
Yeah, I'll get it. I'll get it to you guys to the group either this afternoon or very first thing tomorrow morning.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, there's a lot in the paper that I put together. I kind of outlined a lot of the different issues, and you can translate a lot of those line items into costs, I'm pretty sure. Because a lot of things I just talked about were straight out of that. So I think we could use that as a starting point as well. All right. Did anybody want to talk about the issue of, you know, that we talked about a bit last week, and unfortunately Dave couldn't be on the call this week, but the use of the zone file as a kind of a catalyst or a starting point for abuse of things like spamming and the like. Were there any more comments on that beyond what had already been discussed in the list?
Well, I can talk about that somewhat.
Go for it.
Okay, basically it's very difficult to use the zone file as a raw tool for spamming, and it would have to be processed. Like the main use, like no main malicious use of a zone file, as far as I can see, would be who is mining for slamming and phishing, and also for new TLD targeting. Like as in sort of seeing what domain is really popular across, say, ComNet, Orbis, Info, etc., and then targeting that domain for malicious registration in a new TLD, perhaps with bogus trademark or bogus intellectual property documentation. Like this is actually what happened in .eu there a few years ago. But as a raw tool, like it's the zone file needs a hell of a lot of processing to be useful for a spammer or for a malicious actor.
I'm sorry, I don't recognize that voice. Who just made that comment?
John McCormick.
Oh, thanks, John.
And I think the use for potentially for cyber squatting is certainly one that is going to be, I think, coming much more to the fore. You know, once we start seeing a lot more zones out there and the new TLDs, so it's certainly one to take into consideration. That one you could almost say is a direct use, but it's. Again, you have to process it and have some firepower behind it. And I guess the other question is that information available elsewhere anyways? You can get Alexa numbers and things like that. So there's lots of ways of figuring out what's popular on the Internet.
Well, that's true. There's only about, I think, about 71,000 domains that really are registered, really are the top, the cream of the crop domains. But most of the new TLDs will not do well financially. In fact, they may turn into zombie TLDs. Rather than sort of viable, well-used TLDs. So the amount of targeting that happened over, say, the last 4 years won't happen for most of those new TLDs. The .asia was expected to be heavily targeted, but that's actually sort of really fallen off in terms of targeting and in terms of usage. .eu is a bit of a wasteland at the moment. Even though it's got 3 million domains registered, it isn't actually widely used in Europe. Everything is flipped over towards ccTLDs.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to predict the future, too, because there's a lot of geographic names and other interest. And I think it's fairly widely understood. Part of the scope of this group is that some registries may be really successful and some may be abject failures. But you don't know which ones are going to be in which bins at the time. It's all speculative. But they're all going to be there at least in some form. And depending on how they're set up, we may want to be able to get access, and that's where we're concentrating our efforts. Any other thoughts on that? I know Dave Piscitello threw some email out to the list, I think, last night. And he had a few things there, a few, kind of scary ideas. But it was, I don't know that there was anything in there that you couldn't figure out as a bad guy, just basically using some standard tools, digs and things like that, and data that's available from plenty of sources as to RobTechs and things like that that are out there already. And I know that they're using them to figure this stuff out. Any thoughts on what Dave threw in, or any other concerns here?
This is Mikey. I think that it would be good for us to sort of write up a chunk of the report that clarifies the conversations that maybe distills the conversations we've had and clarifies what the zone file can be used to do in terms of abuse of what it can. For example, there are some misconceptions that if you have a zone file, you've got email addresses, when in fact you don't. And so to the extent that we could clarify which things are the real abuses that could take place, I think that goes into the what's the problem pile as well. It would be useful from the standpoint of building a case for doing this.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. And actually, it could help us segue into the last topic area here as to what to include in the paper, if that's all right with everybody. Is there any other comments on Section 4?
It would be best that we be very careful about including sort of instructions on how to use the zone file for malicious activity.
Yeah, we might want to say what it's not, but not go into a great deal of detail on what it is good for. That's a good point.
Yeah, I think we can review how that is coming along and make sure we don't have a recipe for setting up really nasty attacks.
The main use of the zone files, from what I can see, is for drop lists. That's the most popular use of zone files over the last couple of years.
Well, it's certainly a popular one. It's one that you can monetize, obviously. I'm not sure, if there's more consumers for that, or for trademark protection, or for security work, or what have you. It would be nice if one of the registries does have that data. I know we've asked affiliates if they have some of that information as to who's using it for what. It sounded like VeriSign didn't have that. I think we've identified lots of different things. Getting to item 5, unless there's anything else on discussed. Getting to the paper, then I think we've talked a lot about these various things that need to be added. So I'm looking through these topic lists. I think we've kind of come up with, this cost-benefit stuff, an actual model as well, beyond adding to the background as to what's going on and benefits, et cetera. And I think we can distill the comments that have come in about consumer experience, and get a straw man for that, and figure out where we need to modify that. Anything else that we haven't really talked about in the last couple of calls or on the list that people are thinking we need to make sure gets into the paper?
Rod, this is Mikey. My reaction is that we kind of need to turn the crank of some of the stuff that we've identified on this call, and that may inform put in the paper. We may find some holes after we've done that, but maybe what we should do is crunch away a little bit and see what we wind up with.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've gotten a lot of stuff out there, a lot of really good ideas and discussed in the list and in these calls. Time to kind of quantify that and get it down so people can review that. Any other thoughts on that?
I have a question, Vladimir. To Craig or maybe anyone else from my camp. So when we finish this paper, what will be the next step? I mean, when this group reaches its destination, and we have a draft paper that's agreed by the group. So what will be the next step? Will it be provided for the board? Will it be,
well,
what to anticipate?
Right, Vladimir. So from the start, we've talked about
developing this concept paper and posting it for public comment and public information a couple of weeks before the Nairobi meeting, and then having open discussions about it in Nairobi. So the next step is to publish the paper, invite public comments, and discuss it openly in Nairobi, and then to continue to flush it out in terms of content and details. And I think the end goal here is to have a model or models well defined for inclusion in the next version of the applicant guidebook, which will be due out sometime in May.
Craig, this is Mikey. Is there any, in a lot of cases, this may well turn into stuff that needs a look-see from the GNSO consensus policy standpoint. Is there a plan to run it through that cycle at any point along the way?
I think it certainly will be made available to the GNSO, and they may very well take it up in their public meetings that Saturday and Sunday prior to the start of the meeting in Nairobi. But this is what we're doing is implementation detail for the new GTLD program, and this is not something that is subject to consensus policy. I mean, this is really an implementation plan. What this group is tasked with is providing input to ICANN that will ultimately be considered by the board.
This is Mikey again. Just from a political standpoint, I know that the GNSO gets really cranky if they don't get asked.
They'll get asked for input as well as all the other constituencies.
Yeah, this is sort of a, as I'm sure you're aware, this is becoming a fairly tender subject, especially in the GNSO crowd. So to the extent that we can avoid exacerbating that particular problem, I think we'd be well served by doing that.
Good point.
I think that we need to make sure those concerns are met at least in some form, and then also this pretty much is directly affects registry operators, so it's making sure that the registry constituency and the registry operators are at least happy with happy or at least accepting of the concepts that come out of this. Are comfortable with them in some form or fashion is really important. That's why it's important to get their input in with and make sure that we come up with a model that shows benefits to everybody. I think at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to care about this.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mike.
Okay, logistically, on the paper, I was going to work with Mark, I think, right? Craig, that was the plan?
Yeah, I think so.
So, Mark, you and I should probably circle back sometime today and figure out some timings on how we proceed on that.
Okay, that's good.
Right. I think that's it for the main topics. Was there anything else? We're getting 8:50, so we're 20. 10 minutes under the new time and 20 minutes past the old time. Is there anything else that people wanted to cover today?
The John McCormick, the diff idea from the list.
Ah.
Basically, instead of actually putting out a complete zone file, just put out partials.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that back up. I think that if I remember right, doesn't COM produce some sort of a diff file?
It doesn't. No.
Okay. It must be under the Rapid Zone Update program or something like that they do a diff file. So it is doable. And I think there were some great points raised on the list that. What is a diff file? Right? How do you quantify that? It would certainly on the larger TLDs be useful to have a daily differences file and just download that. If you're already invested in the processing and all the like, it would certainly, I know from our usages, just personally, it would improve things quite a bit. The one area we don't want to intrude upon is that kind of that rapid zone update area, because that's actually a registry service that VeriSign and I think a couple of the other registries, VeriSign already has it, and I think a couple of other registries are looking at as a, what's the term for the extended services, Craig?
They applied for the rapid zone update service under the registry services evaluation process.
Right. And that's certainly a very sensitive area, and I was, you know, when I was writing up some of the things I made very specific in my writing that this anything in the centralized or unified zone access would not intrude upon their ability to provide these enhanced services, which rapid zone updates was one of the ones that's already on the table. And the concept of rapid zone updates, for those who aren't familiar, is that they basically give you an update every 10 minutes or 20 minutes or something like that of everything new, all the changes in the zone. Basically get deltas very quickly. And that's not a free service, not even close. We don't want to intrude upon a business model that's been set up and all that. But the concept of a differential or differences file would certainly make sense on a daily basis, because that's basically what you're doing when you're downloading the zone, for most of us, I think, is figuring out, well, how's it changed? That would be very useful, I think. I'm sorry, I monopolized the conversation. Are there any other comments on that?
My comments are, this is Vladimir, that as I said on the list, this your points are perfectly valid, but only for the large TLDs, which are quantitatively the minority of the TLDs. So that makes me wonder whether this question is within the scope of this group.
Well, as a zone file format, it would be, I think. You'd need new deleted and transferred domains as and their data as part of a diff, rather than a single diff file. It would make it a lot easier to integrate new TLDs with the existing models if this was actually available.
But again, this it's from the consumer standpoint, it's not, or maybe I'm mistaken, you'll correct me, but it's not really an onerous operation to generate the diff file. So it's just some computing resource that's required. On the other hand, the registries are required to provide some level of service. So if any system which is imposed on the registries, the costs of creating and maintaining such a system are like a number of times more than if it would be done from the consumer side.
That's where an aggregator might be very helpful, right? If they're getting the raw files and then computing the difference files and then making those available on a feed to the consumers, then there's only one organization doing all that, name crunching, I guess. So from that perspective, it could actually add value to both sides.
Good point.
I'd agree with the aggregator idea, yeah.
Yeah, believe me, the crunching this COM zone file is the most onerous part of it with that zone file. It is not a trivial computational requirement to do that on a daily basis, much less a, you know.
And MapReduce has now been patented.
Yeah, I haven't put it on the cloud yet, so maybe we'll do it that way someday. Okay, I think that adding that as part of the model discussion as an option, it certainly has some merit. And, you know, at some point we could throw it out if we want to, but from the ability to help scale, on the scalability issue for consumers at least, I think it should be considered as part, is within scope at least, to talk about at this point. We can address that later.
It's more a vertical scalability issue for consumers rather than a horizontal one, I think. Because
yeah.
What .com has grown so massively over the last 10 years, this is where most of the computation is actually thrown at.
Yep. I concur. Although, the smaller ones are, they're not trivial. The medium-sized ones, I guess. Anything else?
So this is Mikey. One last idea, and that is, since we're talking about an aggregator as one solution, we may want to start making a list of policy changes, or at least policy issues that we want to include, because right now, at least in my massive experience of once downloading the .com zone, my recollection is that I was not permitted to use that file for anything else, and we'd have to open up a window for an aggregator to use that file in a way that's outside, I think, the contract terms of that.
Yeah, and that was, we discussed that a call or two ago. That was, how do you firewall that, et cetera, if you have an aggregator,
right,
so that they're not in an unfair position to profit from that unhindered access. And I think that's important as part of the discussion around that, and to assuage some concerns there. I think just to answer the question on whether you can use the data or not, I think that was discussed on the lists a bit. If I remember right, there was there is a clause in there that says you cannot redistribute the data directly, and that you can't make it available in such a way that large portions of it, I believe is how it's phrased, can be discerned via some service. But you can take that data and put it towards value-added services of some sort. It's perfectly fine to do. Am I correct on that, Craig?
Yeah, the restrictions are all in Part 4 of the Standard Zone File Access Agreement.
I guess my main point here is that when we get down to the last strokes, we'll want to make sure that we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's on the policy standpoint.
Yep. Okay, well, we're at the top of the hour, 1 minute from it at least. I want to make sure we get done on the new time. Anything else that's a burning issue, or can we move on to the next week and work on the list?
Next week sounds
Craig,
great.
Okay, Craig, you have any other housekeeping stuff we need to go over?
No. Thank you, though.
Thank you, everybody. It was another really productive call, I think. And I think we'll take a crack at getting an update for this draft here that we can then talk about those changes and what that things look like next week.
Sounds great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Thanks.
Bye.